This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents The Longevity Diet. Discover the new science behind stem cell activation and regeneration to slow aging, fight disease, and optimize weight. By Valter Longo, Ph.D. This book is read by Keith Sellenwright, a member of SAG-AFTRA. To my mother, Angelina, my father, Carmelo, my brother, Claudio, and my sister, Patrizia, and to those seeking solutions, knowledge, and hope. Introduction. Longevity, the fountain of life, the secrets to eternal youth. They have fascinated us from our earliest civilizations, and they have deeply fascinated me since I was a teenager. Back then, I wanted to become a rock star, and I was sure I would always be a professional musician. But my passion to discover the secrets of longevity and how they could revolutionize medicine wouldn't be drowned out, no matter how fantastic a rock career appeared to be. When I was a sophomore in college, I decided to put music to the side and dedicate myself to science so that I could study the processes by which we age. 3 decades later, I still play guitar, but I spend the majority of my time working as the director of the University of Southern California, USC, Longevity Institute in Los Angeles, and the Program on Longevity and Cancer at IFOM, Molecular Oncology, FIRC Institute in Milan, where I combine studies of centenarians with epidemiological studies of populations, clinical trials, and basic research to understand how to help people live long lives. But it's not just the idea of living longer that has driven me. It's living healthy longer, staying vibrant and youthful beyond the traditional life expectancy. To achieve this, my laboratories performed decades of cellular, animal, and human studies focused on maximizing function, learning, memory, physical fitness, etc., and on the prevention and treatment of diseases, with a special focus on cancer, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, as well as autoimmune and neurodegenerative disorders. Contrary to the notion that if we live longer, we will extend the sickness period, our data indicate that by understanding how the human body is maintained while young, we can stay fully functional into our 90s, 100s, and beyond. One of the primary ways to achieve this is to exploit our body's innate ability to regenerate itself at the cellular and organ levels. Unfortunately, the modern diet and the constant consumption that characterizes the way so much of the first world eats keeps these built-in mechanisms permanently switched off, leaving us prematurely vulnerable to disease and degeneration beginning in our 30s and 40s. But as I've discovered over the past 30 years of research, that switch can be turned back on rather easily. The difficult part has been figuring out a way to do it that is feasible and safe for everyone. Let me back up. I was 16 when I first came to America from Genoa, hometown of Christopher Columbus, in the northwest of Italy. That's where I was born and raised, though I spent my summers in Calabria, the southern Italian region where my parents came from. Harboring my dreams of fame and fortune as a rock star, and having driven neighbors in my building crazy for long enough with loud electric guitars, I arrived in Chicago to live with an aunt and pursue my music studies. Along with the thriving music scene and some of the best blues in the nation, I was exposed for the first time to the American diet. Having grown up in two regions with some of the healthiest cuisines in the world, and never really having thought about it, I was amazed at the giant portions, the huge amounts of meat and cheese consumed at almost every meal, the sugary drinks and snacks so readily available. The other thing I noticed was that my Italian relatives living in Chicago were developing diabetes, heart disease, and other ailments uncommon to the family back home. At the time, I didn't think much of it. But later, these exposures motivated me and helped me solidify hypotheses about diet, diseases, and longevity. By the time I got to the University of North Texas, just outside of Dallas a few years later, to continue my music education, my fascination with aging had taken hold. All my friends who were approaching or past 30 were starting to lament getting old. But something else, maybe my having been in the room when my grandfather died, was stuck in my head, waiting for an opportunity to guide me in a new direction. As much as I loved music, in my second year as an undergraduate, I realized that what I really wanted to do with my life was study how people stay young. So I moved to the biochemistry department to begin studying aging. 4 years later, I entered one of the best programs for the biology of aging, the pathology PhD programs at the University of California, Los Angeles, and the laboratory of Roy Walford, MD, who at the time was the world's leading expert on nutrition and longevity, a field that was just beginning to come into its own. The rest is history. I have now been researching healthy longevity for more than 30 years, studying the links between nutrition and the genes that regulate cellular protection and regeneration. The longevity diet collects what I have learned and puts it into a simple program anyone can live by. It is as simple as adopting the daily nutritional regimen I outline and combining it periodically, 2 to 12 times per year, depending on your general health, with my fasting-mimicking diet, FMD, which is exactly what it sounds like, a diet that mimics a fast, providing the benefits of fasting without the deprivation and hunger. Combining these two elements, I have discovered, can protect, regenerate, and rejuvenate the body to keep us young and healthy longer. This is achieved in part by turning back the biological aging clock, which means that these diets can be adopted by relatively young people to help delay aging and prevent disease, and also by older individuals to help them return to a more youthful state. The FMD is also clinically proven to stimulate the loss of abdominal fat while conserving muscle and bone mass. These benefits are generated by switching on the human body's own remarkable ability to activate stem cells and regenerate parts of cells, systems, and organs, leading to a reduction of risk factors for many diseases. In the chapters that follow, I will explain first why it works, then how it works. I will also explain how we took advantage of scientific and clinical experience to make nutritional strategies safe and feasible while minimizing the need for drastic dietary changes. Our dietary interventions are now recommended by thousands of doctors in the United States, Europe, and Asia. Among other things that I believe set this book apart from the thousands of other diet and wellness books out there is that it is based on a solid multidisciplinary foundation. We are constantly bombarded with new science that demonizes or exalts one food or another. For this reason, I devised a methodology that would ensure the widest possible scientific basis for my recommendations. I call this method the 5 pillars of longevity. These pillars do not refer to specific interventions such as diet and exercise, but to 5 disciplines that provide the foundation for my nutrition program. 1. Basic juventology research. Juventology, as I will explain, is the science of staying young. 2. Epidemiology. 3. Clinical studies. 4. Studies of centenarians. And 5. The understanding of complex systems, like cars, for example. By thus providing the widest, most solid grounds possible for dietary and exercise recommendations, we not only ensure their efficacy, but we also reduce to a minimum the chance that a future set of studies will drastically alter them. The past 30 years of research and learning from many scientists in these different fields have allowed me to build a system that I believe is solid enough that you can use it for life. My search for the secrets to youthful longevity has led me all around the world, from Los Angeles to the Andes of southern Ecuador, from Okinawa, Japan to Russia, from the Netherlands to southern Germany. But ultimately, it led me back to Italy. Though I had no idea of this when I was growing up, the part of northern Italy where I was born and raised happens to be home to one of the highest percentages of people over age 65 in the world, 28.3%, according to the Italian National Institute of Statistics in 2016. And the region in the south, where I spent every summer of my childhood, has, we discovered, one of the highest proportions of centenarians worldwide. It has been a very surprising coincidence, but also a confirmation and privilege of my life's work to take my studies back to where I grew up and be able to see that part of the world again through the eyes of people who have lived long, healthy, and full lives there. Inspired by all my long-lived friends back home and around the world, this book is for anyone who wishes to join their ranks. A note on proceeds and products. This book gives you the advantage of many years of research into how to live long and healthy lives, but there is another benefit. With 100% of my book royalties going to charity, you'll also be helping to fund valuable research through organizations like the Create Cures Foundation, www.createcures.org, a nonprofit organization I founded to support people with advanced stage or complex diseases in need of integrative and more effective treatments. Every day I get emails from people who have been diagnosed with serious diseases, cancer, autoimmune and metabolic disorders, neurodegenerative diseases, etc., seeking options beyond the standard treatments offered by their doctors. Unfortunately, professional guidelines, fear of legal action, heavy caseloads, and the complexity of illness work to keep doctors narrowly focused on standard of care treatments, and often patients aren't given integrative options even if they ask. As I spent time with clinicians working on innovative therapies for cancer and other diseases, it became clear that they needed researchers like me to help them offer integrative interventions that could be safe, built on solid research, and advantageous to their patients, who in many cases do not have the option of waiting years for the end of large clinical trials. This is how I came to start the Create Cures Foundation. Our mission is to make evidence-based information available to the public, to empower those who want to complement traditional treatments with reliable, scientifically based, and clinically tested strategies to improve the efficacy of the therapy, but also reduce its side effects. Our goal is not to diminish the role of medical doctors in patient care, but to enhance it by providing information on integrative approaches supported by strong animal and clinical data. We live in a time when funding for research is getting tighter, with very little going to creative or alternative ideas, which is why my profits from the sale of this book will go straight to the Create Cures Foundation and other nonprofit universities and institutes. So go ahead and buy more copies. Give them to your friends and family. You'll be helping whomever you give it to, and you'll also be directly funding our ongoing research into aging, cancer, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, cardiovascular disease, multiple sclerosis, Crohn's disease and colitis, and type 1 and type 2 diabetes. I list these particular diseases because we have performed basic research on all of them and are planning or have started, and in some cases completed, clinical trials with documented success. We are committed to transforming research into improved, applicable therapies as rapidly as we can by thinking broadly and creatively. Our approach is to work with as many leading hospitals and research institutes as possible. At the moment, these include Harvard, the Mayo Clinic, Charité University Medicine Berlin, Leiden University, and the University of Geneva, among many others. Even as we continue to perform our own basic research and clinical trials at USC's Leonard Davis School of Gerontology and Keck Medical Center, one of the largest and best university hospitals in the United States, and at the IFOM Cancer Research Institute in Milan, Italy. You can receive updates on our research, including upcoming clinical trials, on my Facebook page, at Prof. Walter Longo, and at www.createcures.org. Virtually every one of the patients who wrote to me asked the same question. Having heard that my fasting-mimicking diet can bring all the benefits of fasting without the actual fasting part, they want to know what they can eat while on the fast. In response, and in order to make the FMD available as well as safe and effective for everyone, I started a company called L-Nutra, www.l-nutra.com. With support from the U.S. National Cancer Institute, the National Institute on Aging, and other funding agencies, we first developed a clinically tested FMD for cancer patients, ChemoLeave. Then one for everyone, Prolon. 100% of my shares in L-Nutra are committed to the Create Cures Foundation and other nonprofit organizations involved in research relevant to our mission. I receive neither a salary nor a consulting fee from L-Nutra, though in the interest of full disclosure, I do receive minimal expense reimbursement. Although I do not directly make pricing decisions, I am committed to ensuring that L-Nutra's products are as affordable as possible without compromising quality or the company's ability to grow and make its products available around the world. Prolon is already available through the L-Nutra website in the United States and is recommended by a network of physicians and other healthcare professionals. ChemoLeave is currently being tested at several leading cancer centers, including USC, the Mayo Clinic, and Leiden University, and there is a long list of institutions waiting to test different FMDs for many diseases and conditions as soon as funding becomes available. Many eager patients have asked whether it's necessary to buy the products and use them under supervision, or whether they can just do the FMD themselves at home. I always answer the question by first reminding people that half of my program, the Everyday Longevity Diet part, consists of foods that can be purchased in any supermarket and does not require supervision or specially formulated products. The longevity diet alone will help prevent and treat many diseases and will also reduce the recommended frequency of the FMD. That said, when it comes to the FMD, after years of experience with patients doing it in different ways, with the product and without, under supervision and not, I've concluded that it should really be done with the clinically tested product and preferably under the supervision of a registered dietitian or physician. Although all ingredients are completely safe, fasting and FMDs have powerful effects that can be turned against aging and diseases, but that can also result in side effects, in some cases severe. The use of the clinically tested product, along with the right screening and supervision, will guarantee maximum safety and efficacy. The great majority of experts recommend that prolonged fasting periods, anything more than one day, be done only in clinics under the supervision of specialized medical personnel. The clinically tested Prolon FMD will allow most people to do the diet at home. If you are healthy and have the means and access to consult a registered dietitian before undertaking the FMD, especially for the first time, it is strongly recommended that you do so. If you have been diagnosed with a disease, you must have the approval of your doctor. You can find information and specialists on L-Nutra's website. Chapter 1. Caruso's Fountain. Back to Molokio. Drive an hour and a half north from the southernmost tip of Italy, and you'll reach a little town called Molokio in the region of Calabria. Its name is probably derived from the Greek word molucha, meaning mallow, which is a medicinal plant with a bright purple flower. In the central piazza, there's a fountain you can safely drink from, its cold water flowing via underground springs directly from the Aspromonte Mountains. In 1972, when I was 5 years old, I spent 6 months in Molokio with my mother, who had gone there to stay with my ailing grandfather. For many years, my nonno Alfonso had neglected a hernia, a simple condition that could have been treated with the right care. The day he died, everyone was calling his name to wake him. I walked in the room and said, "Can't you see that he has died already?" I was very close to my grandfather, and his death caused me great sadness, but even as a child I felt that dealing with aging and death was something that I was supposed to do, that I had to take charge of the situation somehow. Our neighbor in Molokio, Salvatore Caruso was about the same age as my grandfather. In 2012, 40 years after my grandfather's death, Salvatore and I would appear in the same issue of the scientific journal Cell Metabolism for my group's discovery that a low-protein diet, based on the eating habits of Molacchio's elders, is associated with low cancer and overall mortality rates in the U.S. population. The cover image of 108-year-old Salvatore standing among the Calabrian olive trees made the pages of the Washington Post and media around the globe. 2 years after that, Salvatore was the oldest man in Italy and one of four centenarians living in Molacchio. Since there were only around 2,000 people living there at the time, this meant Molacchio had one of the highest proportions of centenarians in the world, four times that of Okinawa, Japan, which is believed to have the highest rate of centenarians for a large region. Salvatore, who died in 2015 at the age of 110, started drinking from Molacchio's fountain soon after he was born in 1905. Given the exceptional longevity of so many of the town elders, it's tempting to think it might be the closest thing we have to a real fountain of youth. But while that's an interesting thought, I've spent most of my life studying the science of living long, and the truth is nothing so enchanted. You don't need to travel to Molacchio to drink from its fountain of youth, but if you did, you would learn many of the secrets of longevity from its centenarians. From tradition to science. Whether by luck or destiny, my life took a path that has given me a unique and invaluable perspective on different diets and cultures. From the Calabrian diet of Molacchio, where I spent childhood summers, to the pescatarian Ligurian diet of Genoa, where I was raised, to the heavy American diets of Chicago and Texas, to the health-obsessed diet of that mecca of youthfulness, Los Angeles, I've lived the full range of good, bad, and excellent nutrition, which has helped me formulate hypotheses about the connection between food, disease, and longevity. It also helped me realize that in order to understand how people can live long, healthy lives, we need to go beyond scientific, epidemiological, and clinical studies and investigate actual populations that age successfully. Although I didn't know it at the time, I grew up between two places that boast among the healthiest traditional diets in the world. Unlike other regions of Italy famous for their meats, Tuscany, or their heavy cream-based sauces, Lazio, Emilia-Romagna, Liguria and Calabria maintained a cuisine based on complex carbohydrates and vegetables, with dishes like minestrone, panzotte al sugo di noce, a ravioli-like pasta with vegetable filling served in a walnut sauce, and farinata, garbanzo beans and olive oil. During the summers of my childhood in Calabria, we lived simply. Almost every morning, my brother or sister or I walked up the hill to the bakery to buy fresh bread, hot from the oven, dark from the whole wheat from which it was made. About once every other day, for either lunch or dinner, we ate pasta e vianella, which consisted of a small amount of pasta tossed together with large amounts of vegetables, particularly green beans cooked in the pod. Another common dish was stoccafisso, or stockfish, a dried cod similar to baccalà but without the salt, served with a vegetable side dish. Other common ingredients of our diet growing up were black olives, olive oil, and lots of tomatoes, cucumbers, and green peppers. Meat was a once-a-week treat. Only on Sundays would we have homemade macaroni pasta with polpette, meatballs, two each, or sometimes a small steak. The most common drinks were water from the mountain spring, local wine, tea, coffee, and almond milk. We often drank goat's milk instead of cow's milk in the morning. Between meals, we were allowed to snack only on peanuts, almonds, hazelnuts, walnuts, raisins, grapes, or corn on the cob. Once we finished dinner around 8 p.m., we usually wouldn't eat anything until the next morning. Even at our celebratory village fairs, the sweets were made with nuts and dried fruit. And instead of ice cream, we would often have granita, the frozen dessert somewhere between a smoothie and a sorbet. Made with lots of fruit, it is, in my opinion, the best dessert in the world, but it does contain a lot of sugar. We had to go 6 miles down the road to the town of Taurianova to find the good one. The traditional diet of Genoa and its region Liguria is arguably as healthy as that of Calabria's. Low in sugar, it consists of a lot of vegetables, garbanzo beans, olive oil, anchovies, codfish, and mussels, all of which represent important components of the longevity diet I present in this book. From Ligurian to Chicagoan. When I was 12 years old, I would lock myself in my room with my electric guitar, turn the amplifier up to 10, and play along to the albums of Dire Straits, Jimi Hendrix, and Pink Floyd. I dreamed of going to America to become a rock star. That opportunity came in 1984, when, at age 16, I left Genoa to live with my aunt in Chicago. A music-crazed teenager, I arrived in the Little Italy district of Melrose Park in the Chicago suburbs, with my guitar sticking out of my backpack, lugging a portable amp. My spoken language skills were so bad that the immigration official stamped "No English" on my passport. Chicago had an incredible music scene. I took guitar lessons with Stuart Pierce, an iconic local bebop player. I was mostly interested in rock, but I knew that learning to play jazz and bebop would make me a much better rock guitar player. On weekends, I would sneak out of my aunt's house and take the L train downtown, where I would plug in and jam with musicians in blues clubs all night long. My exposure to some of the best blues in the world coincided with my exposure to some of the unhealthiest food in the world, what I consider the heart attack diet. At the time, I knew nothing about nutrition and aging, but I remember thinking something must be wrong with the Windy City diet because so many of my relatives there, mostly ethnic Calabrians, were dying of cardiovascular diseases, which were relatively uncommon in southern Italy in general and were particularly rare in my extended family. These southern Italians in America were eating bacon and sausage with eggs for breakfast, then lots of pasta, bread, and meat for lunch, often having meat again for dinner. They also consumed high quantities of cheese, milk, and high-fat, high-sugar desserts. The famous Chicago pizza had more calories from cheese than from the dough. Drinks were usually sodas or equally high-fructose fruit juices. To make matters worse, much of the food we Chicagoans ate was fried. Not surprisingly, many people I knew were overweight or obese by age 30. Although I never became obese, I ate like everyone else and grew a lot during my 3 years in Chicago. My height shot up to 6'2", almost 8 inches taller than my father and 4 inches taller than my brother. A possible explanation for this was all the meat suddenly in my diet, which, along with protein, probably contained steroid hormones. I graduated high school in Chicago and headed south to study jazz performance at the famous University of North Texas College of Music. I could never have imagined eating more or becoming bigger than I was in Chicago until I joined the Army Reserve as a way to pay for my education in Texas. Arriving for boot camp in Fort Knox, Kentucky, I joined a battalion of Army tankers who trained with the Marines and took pride in pushing themselves to the limit. We slept only 3 or 4 hours a night, did push-ups and other vigorous exercises all day long, and we ate a lot. I spent 2 summers at Fort Knox doing things I never would have believed myself capable of. It was the toughest and probably the best training of my life. The Army taught me how to get things done quickly, meeting the highest standards while minimizing or eliminating mistakes. Our trainers expected the impossible all the time. If you could do 50 push-ups, they told us, you should be going for 100. If you could run 2 miles in 12 minutes, they'd scream, you should finish in 10. I found out that sometimes when the impossible is expected, it can be achieved. Eventually, I was able to run 2 miles in 10 minutes. The Army diet was based on meat and carbohydrates, with sugary sodas allowed as a reward only if we had a combined run, push-up, and sit-up score of 200. which meant about 70 push-ups and 60 sit-ups in under 2 minutes each, plus running 2 miles in under 10.5 minutes. In retrospect, I can see how addicted we all were to sugary drinks. We craved that mix of phosphoric acid, caramel coloring, and sugar, and everyone envied the very few who could reach that 200-point mark. This diet, along with the grueling exercise regimen, made me a lot bigger, increasing the size of my muscles and making me stronger. At least, that's what I assumed at the time. As I will explain in more detail in a later chapter, our recent studies indicate that a protein-rich diet, which can increase muscle size, may not necessarily translate into increased muscle strength, and that a periodic low-protein, low-sugar diet, alternating with periods of normal protein intake, may do more to generate new muscle cells, which we currently think has more to do with strength than size does, while promoting health. In the 10 years after basic training, during which my diet consisted of a lot of meat, fats, and proteins, my strength and stamina were dramatically reduced. But then I slowly switched to the longevity diet, and more than 25 years later, I can do about the same number of push-ups and sit-ups as I did at boot camp when I was 19 and supposedly in peak shape. My stint in the Army eventually got me interested in how and why different types of diets can improve health without negatively affecting muscle mass and strength. The answer lies in nutritechnology, a new field I have helped create in which we treat ingredients found in normal food as a complex set of molecules that, in specific doses and combinations, can have drug-like beneficial properties that we can harness to delay aging and prevent disease. In tune with evolution. My destination after finishing boot camp was Denton, Texas, just north of Dallas, home of the University of North Texas and one of the largest and best jazz performance programs in the world, where I was set to pursue an undergraduate degree in jazz performance. The program was tough, requiring an all-out 16-hour-a-day, 7-days-a-week effort as a freshman. Jazz greats, like pianist Dan Hurley and guitarist Jack Peterson, became my teachers. Many people in my career as a scientist, who know about my beginnings as a jazz musician, wonder how I came to make such a drastic change in my life's direction. The truth is, though music and science are obviously very different, you might be surprised at how much my musical training has helped me in the lab and spurred me on to discoveries that required creative approaches. If you're trained from childhood to recognize chords, the ability to recognize frequencies and intervals isn't that difficult. It's like learning a new language, akin to a child recognizing spoken words and understanding what is being said. However, I was a mostly self-taught guitar player who learned through listening, so being all of a sudden exposed to a new language was particularly challenging for me. In the jazz program, I learned how to understand and write in a language I had always known simply as sound. Similarly, as a scientist, you are always observing. But that observation is useless if you can't transform it into data or hypotheses. Musical training turned out to be essential for many of the discoveries I made about why we age and how it's connected to nutrition. When I started my research on aging, everyone could see that organisms aged, and everyone suspected that genes were somehow involved in that process. But the scientific community had no idea how to translate these observations into quantifiable genetic and molecular explanations. What were the harmonies and melodies of life and death? How could we decipher and transcribe these incredibly complex processes so that we might act upon and change them? As an example of how my music training informed my scientific inquiry, here's one of my favorite analogies, which I use to explain what's missing from the prevalent free radical theory of aging, which holds that antioxidants alone, higher doses of vitamin C, for example, can extend the healthy human lifespan. Trying to extend your lifespan by increasing your intake of vitamin C is like trying to improve a Mozart symphony by increasing the number of cello players. The cello is a beautiful instrument, but to improve a Mozart symphony, you need to be a better composer than Mozart. Adding cellos alone won't do it. The healthy human lifespan is much more complex than a Mozart symphony. It took billions of years of evolution for it to reach the current state of near perfection. We cannot expect a simple supplement to make something that's almost perfect even better, so we cannot expect that we will live healthier and longer lives just by drinking orange juice. Not surprisingly, supplementation with antioxidants has not even been shown to extend the lifespan of mice. Another advantage musical studies gave me as a scientist was a training in improvisation and composition, important elements in jazz to be sure, and also in science. Improvisation challenges you to understand what you hear in relation to what you play so thoroughly and instantaneously that you can react to and match it on the fly. But this is only the start, since in jazz, eventually the improvisation breaks free from the chord progression, often violating rules that would never be violated in classical music. However, the improviser is always aware of the chords, and the violation must follow new rules, albeit much more flexible ones. In science, this skill keeps you on the lookout for ideas that might be new or surprising, but that are also well-grounded, as opposed to looking for trendy discoveries that are just variations on previous breakthroughs. Composition, instead, forces you to write music that no one has written before, but unlike with improvisation, the music must be structured, and all the melodies and harmonies, as well as the instruments playing them and the way they are played, must be defined. In science and medicine, the music composer approach pushes you to look for new ideas, new hypotheses, but it also requires that the intervention has a mathematical foundation and is in harmony with the human body and its history. I call this being in tune with evolution. For example, as I will discuss elsewhere in the book, if we use a drug that lowers glucose, we are not considering the harmony of the human body, since that drug is disrupting a normal function of the organism. Although this may lead to a temporary solution, lower glucose, in the long run it will usually also lead to problems, adverse side effects. If instead we can rejuvenate the insulin-resistant muscle cells that cause the high glucose levels and render them more functional, we are making changes that maintain and even increase the harmony of the human body. Further, if this rejuvenation is activated by taking advantage of environments and conditions that echo our past and more ancient organisms, then we are not only taking advantage of the harmony, but we are also in tune with evolution, since that process matches the frequencies of our history. Fasting, which is the focus of much of this book, activates coordinated responses that are in tune with evolution, because starvation was encountered by all organisms, starting with bacteria, billions of years before Homo sapiens even existed. For this reason, it is clearly one of the most powerful interventions we can rediscover to promote coordinated changes that do not disrupt the harmony of the human body. Without scientists and researchers thinking outside the box and being open to new possibilities and ideas, many of the greatest scientific and medical discoveries could never have been made, from Alexander Fleming's discovery of penicillin to James Watson and Francis Crick and others' unraveling of the structure of DNA. It was at the University of North Texas that I decided to switch my studies from music to science. One day during my second year there, an academic counselor asked me when I was going to enroll in music teaching, a course in which I would have to direct a marching band. It was the marching band that decided it. I had no intention of ever leading a marching band. For one thing, I was a rock musician. But for another, was this really what I wanted to do with my life? All of a sudden, I didn't think so. I still play guitar to this day, but after a few days of wandering the streets of Denton, Texas, I decided that I wanted to devote my life to the study of how we age, or rather, how we might stay young and healthy for as long as possible. I had noticed people I knew in their 30s worrying about getting old, and it seemed like 40 was the age at which people started to become vulnerable to major disease. As a 20-year-old, I wondered, why can't we push that back to 50, 60, even further? The field of aging provided a fantastic opportunity. It combined the impossible scientific task of understanding why we grow old and die with the idea I was just beginning to understand, that if we can effectively act on the aging process, we can postpone and even prevent many common diseases, enabling people to stay young and healthy as long as possible. Along with my musical training, another element of my background has helped me in my career, and that is self-doubt. After making the decision to switch programs, I went to see the chairman of the biochemistry department, excited to discuss my new program of study. He was, to put it mildly, highly skeptical of a jazz performance major who had never taken a biology course, who now wanted to transfer into the biochemistry program to study aging. He told me that I was crazy and that I wouldn't last a semester. His reaction gave me pause. Maybe he was right. My father was a policeman, and my mother, as was the cultural norm when I grew up, ran the house and only worked occasionally as a tailor. Neither of my parents, who had emigrated to Genoa from the South, had more than a primary school education. So I wasn't sure I could do it. Maybe I was being presumptuous. Maybe it was ridiculous to think that I'd be able to keep up. In retrospect, I realize it was probably this doubt that helped me succeed in the program and as a scientist. My lab's motto and modus operandi is paranoia. On the one hand, I teach my students never to trust their results nor those of others, and always to expect that something will go wrong. The great result they might be so excited about will probably change under further scrutiny and experimentation, or when looked at from a different angle. On the other hand, I teach them that everything is possible. Think of big ideas. If you can dream it, you might be able to do it. Our popular culture depicts scientists as confident leader types, sure of what they're doing and the outcomes they will achieve. And it's true that this is a mindset I frequently encounter at universities and in hospitals. Even in my college days, though, I understood that confidence was a way for arrogance to usurp knowledge. I believe the most revolutionary discoveries come from creativity and doubts, because they first appear as crazy ideas, but then undergo a grueling process that makes them real and repeatable. I didn't let my doubts stop me back then, and a year later I was thriving in the biochemistry program, working in the lab of the same doctor who had so doubted me. Soon I would be driving 60 miles a day to work in the lab of Dr. Robert Gracie, a leading aging research expert in Texas, where I would begin studying one of the most important aspects of aging, the process by which proteins are damaged. We can think of proteins as both the bricks that support an organism and the switchboard that transmits biological information from cell to cell or within cells. For example, growth hormone is the protein that circulates in the blood, activating growth hormone receptors on the surface of cells, which promotes human growth. Like all proteins, growth hormone can be modified and damaged through aging, which can affect its function. Dr. Gracie's research group was studying how to potentially reverse this protein damage. This study would be the beginning of my research in the extraordinary field of longevity. Hamburgers, French fries, and other unhealthy foods, especially Tex-Mex, remained my everyday diet throughout my undergraduate studies in Texas. Tex-Mex combines the worst food elements, transforming the relatively healthy Mexican cuisine into a terribly unhealthy one by frying everything and adding low-quality cheeses and meats. In spite of my new area of study, it didn't occur to me yet that my diet could affect my health and might be setting me up for disease. Not surprisingly, a few years after graduating from college, my cholesterol and blood pressure were high, and doctors were ready to load me up with statins and hypertension drugs. but by then I had joined the UCLA laboratory of Dr. Roy Walford, who was at the time the world's leading expert on nutrition and longevity. My diet and life were both about to change. Chapter 2. Aging, Programmed Longevity, and Juventology. Why We Age. The approach in this book is different from that of the great majority of nutrition books because I focus on keeping organisms young, not treating individual diseases or conditions. So it's important to understand what aging is and the strategies that have the best chance of slowing it down without causing side effects. Aging refers to the changes that occur over time to both organisms and objects. These changes aren't necessarily negative. In fact, although humans and most other organisms become dysfunctional in old age, growing older can actually bring improvements as well. For example, New York Marathon winners are typically in their 30s, and many of the top finishers are in their 40s. This suggests that there can be overall positive changes in the human body associated with aging. So, why do we age? Clearly, every object around us, from houses to cars, gets old and deteriorates. So, perhaps a better question is this: why wouldn't humans and all other organisms also age and die? Natural selection, the process Charles Darwin and Alfred Wallace described to explain evolution, has resulted in mechanisms that can protect an organism, such as DNA repair, until it can generate healthy offspring. Over millions of years of evolution, the lifespan of an organism will tend to get longer if its ability to generate healthy offspring also increases. Both Wallace and Darwin also hypothesized that aging and death may be programmed so that organisms could age on purpose and die prematurely if it were advantageous to the species, to avoid overcrowding, for example. You can think of it like a company that establishes mandatory retirement at age 65 in order to allow younger employees to be hired, with the idea that ultimately this benefits the company. Both scientists abandoned this theory because at the time it would have been extremely difficult to demonstrate, since they did not have the computational molecular biology and genetics tools we have now. A century and a half later, my laboratory produced one of the first pieces of experimental evidence for this programmed aging hypothesis. We showed that a selfish group of microorganisms, in this case baker's yeast, that had been genetically manipulated to invest in their own protection and live as long as possible, would eventually become extinct, whereas shorter-lived microorganisms willing to sacrifice themselves and die early would seed future generations. In other words, the genetic alterations that make the organism act selfishly and live longer decrease its chances of generating healthy offspring. Whether human beings are actually programmed to die, however, has not been demonstrated. To fully demonstrate programmed aging, one must first demonstrate group selection, one of the most hotly debated and challenged theories of evolutionary biology. Group selection posits that groups of organisms can act in an altruistic way to protect or benefit the group at the individual's expense. In most cases, it can be argued that altruistic behavior, a bird flying in front of the flock, for instance, thereby taking additional risks for the sake of the group, is just a case of paying one's dues, and that the risk taken will eventually benefit the individual taking the risk. But when an organism dies to benefit others, it's impossible to deem it a selfish act. Either death is occurring by chance, that is, it serves no purpose, or it's programmed and altruistic. Over the past 10 years, I have argued for programmed aging in a series of public debates against experts who argued for traditional evolutionary aging theories. After 2 such debates in Texas and California, the audience, made up of scientists, was asked to vote on the theory that seemed right. In both cases, I lost, though the vote and following discussions suggested I had convinced nearly half of them. Why? I believe it's because current evolutionary theories are accepted as dogma, and most scientists just aren't willing to consider alternative possibilities. To maximize the chance for everyone to make it to 110 healthy, it is important to consider these evolutionary theories and take advantage of the programs that have evolved to extend longevity in response to the changes in the environment. For example, we showed that the altruistic death program described above is inactivated by starvation, indicating that an organism left without food no longer dies to benefit others, probably because the others are not expected to be around to benefit. There are hundreds of theories of how and why we age. Many are partially true and overlap. For example, the popular free radical theory of aging I already mentioned proposes that oxygen and other reactive molecules that function as oxidants can cause damage to virtually all components of a cell and organism, similar to the rusting of metals when exposed to oxygen and water. Tom Kirkwood's disposable soma theory is another well-received theory of aging. It proposes that organisms invest in reproduction, in offspring, and in themselves, but only to the level necessary to generate healthy offspring. The soma, our body, which is the carrier of the genetic material contained in our sperm cells and oocytes, is therefore disposable once it has generated a sufficient number of offspring. Unflattering as it sounds, under this theory, we are merely disposable carriers of DNA. Because these theories focus on the aging process and not on the potential for organisms to stay young, 15 years ago I came up with my own explanation of aging, the programmed longevity theory. I proposed that an organism could, in fact, afford a greater investment in self-protection against aging, and that this could have important implications for human life and the prevention of diseases, since by altering the longevity program, we could postpone the age at which we begin to become frail and sick. Imagine, for example, moving this age from 50 to 70. If this is possible, you might wonder, then why did this longevity program ever become dormant? The answer is not that it is impossible to maximize both protection and reproduction, but that the level of current protection is sufficient to carry out the task. The other reason for the program to have remained dormant is that historically we reproduced, or tried to reproduce, much more frequently than we do now. So for the great majority of human history, activating a program that reroutes so much energy away from reproduction to use for protection and repair would not have been advantageous. Consider this analogy. Would it be possible to build a plane that could fly years longer than current models without its performance suffering? The answer is yes. There are at least two ways to accomplish this. One, the longer-lived plane would need more fuel and more maintenance for each mile it flies to prevent damage. Two, the longer-lived plane would require superior technology to reduce damage while using the same amount of fuel and maintenance as current models. Now, let's apply this to humans. One, people who live longer would need more energy to perform more maintenance, DNA repair, cellular regeneration, etc. Two, people who live longer would need to get better at utilizing energy to increase protection against aging and maintaining normal function for longer. However, there may be no evolutionary reason to do it, because for the human species to continue to thrive, aging and death at 80 is perfectly acceptable. But what if we wanted to be just a little more selfish and live an extra 30 healthy years? Is it possible to improve the protection and repair systems to stay young longer, or even become younger? Or have we reached a maximum level of protection? I believe, and the data indicate, that we have not, that it is indeed possible to improve the body's protective systems or make these systems continue to work longer so that we undergo decline and begin to encounter diseases not at age 40 to 50, but at age 60 to 70, or better yet, never encounter many of them at all. In the following chapters, I will show how genetic or dietary interventions can not only delay diseases, but actually eliminate a major portion of chronic diseases in mice, monkeys, and even humans to extend longevity. At the foundation of these effects is what I called programmed longevity, a biological strategy to influence longevity and health through cellular protection and regeneration to stay younger longer. Juventology. Discussions about theories of aging are great entertainment for scientists, but not much use to anyone else. Under the programmed longevity theory, how and why we age is not as interesting as how we stay young. Because of the importance of this distinction, I coined a term for this area of inquiry. Juventology, the study of youth. What's the difference? A great deal. If you're trying to understand why a car ages, you might study the engine and conclude that over time it slowly rusts. To make it last longer, you might add an antioxidant additive to the fuel or motor oil. This is essentially what the free radical theory of aging supports as a way to extend healthy longevity. But this is like what I said before about vitamin C and the Mozart symphony. You can't improve Mozart's compositions by just adding cellos. You have to write a better symphony. But for the sake of argument, let's suppose that you could slow the aging of the engine a little by adding a lot of antioxidants. This aging process, and the small effect of the antioxidants on it, becomes irrelevant, however, if the owner of the car rebuilds the engine every 10 years, replacing the damaged parts with brand new ones. The same applies to the human body. We can try to understand how it ages and attempt to slow that down, or we can identify ways to eliminate aged components and periodically replace them with young ones. In this case, it doesn't matter how the body ages, whether by oxidation or some other mechanism. The goal changes from protecting the body from damage to improving protection and, more importantly, repair and replacement regeneration. In both cases, the body ages with time, but if we can program health to last longer, the system will trigger protection, repair, and replacement mechanisms to maintain the organism's vigor and functionality. This is the difference between the current gerontology aging-based approach and what I think is a more effective juventology-based approach. It is worth keeping in mind that protecting the body from aging and damage is also important because we are a long way from being able to repair and replace molecules, cells, and systems perfectly. Thus, combining the gerontology and juventology approaches is ideal. Throughout this book, I will describe specific dietary changes that have protective, regenerating, and rejuvenating effects. As my laboratory has discovered, there is a clear connection between nutrients and longevity genes, which can be activated to promote cellular reprogramming and regeneration so that an organism can stay healthy longer, and as a consequence, maximize what we call health span, or healthy lifespan. The discovery of the aging genes and networks. To keep organisms young, we must reprogram the youth period from a 40 to 50 year length to a 60 to 70 year program or longer. To learn how to reprogram longevity, though, I had to better understand its molecular mechanisms. The dietary interventions described later in the book are based on discoveries made in part by my laboratory's research into just this. In 1992, I came to UCLA, at that time one of the world's leading centers of longevity research, to devote myself to the genetics and biochemistry of longevity. I had put my career as a rock guitarist on hold, though I did perform in Los Angeles and toured on the West Coast during my first 3 years of graduate school. Perhaps influenced by the Hollywood obsession with staying eternally young, each of the two rival research universities of the City of Angels had attracted its own master in the field of aging. Famous pathologist Roy Walford was at UCLA, and renowned neurobiologist Caleb Finch was at USC. I elected to join Walford's group for my